You're still pretty sick. My name is Gene, and I too am an alcoholic. And always when I identify myself as an alcoholic, I base that identification on my interpretation of the definition of the word alcoholic, as it's defined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics. And in that book, they said this: we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all they said. They didn't make any reference to how much we drank, what we drank, where we drank, or what happened as a result of our drinking. They didn't say in order to be an alcoholic, you got to live on Skid Row, drink wine, spend weekends in drunk tanks, marry the same woman 4 or 5 times. And those things can and do happen to people who don't drink, you know. It's certainly nice to be invited back here to Utah again. I've been here a number of times, and I'm a little confused as to what to lie about tonight, because I don't want to get... I'd certainly be remiss if I didn't thank the committee for asking me here. I have nothing to complain about. Well, two things. I was in the pool this afternoon. I like to get my hands on that little brat that was there with his mother. And says, "Hey, Ma, look, there's Shamu." And the only bad thing about the hotel is the towels are too thick. I can't get them in my suitcase. People often wonder where Calistoga, California is. For a while, I used to wonder where it was, too, to tell you the truth. Calistoga's in Northern California. I live 80 miles north of San Francisco in what is commonly known in California as the wine country. The world-famous Napa Valley, you know, a very enchanting place. If any of you had ever seen a TV program called Falcon Crest, that's where I live. And that's kind of a community, a little 4,000 people, you know, and not a big deal or nothing like that. But we have the same problems that they have in cities of 4 million people, and we have AA groups there, 31 little groups in our little town, and that's pretty good for a town of that size. I'm not from California originally. I'm born and raised in the Lower East Side of New York City, and usually that's what I blame my ignorance on, because it will be aware to you shortly that I don't have any education at all. And that's really not... I used to be ashamed to tell people that, you know. But I'm not really ashamed of it anymore, because what the hell, you know? And in every educational institution in the classes as you went through school, you know, there was always three groups of students. They put the just took up the collection. I put in a 5 for you. They have three kinds of students in the classes, you know. There's usually the brainy kids, you know, A's, all A's and all that. Then the average kids. C, B, and stuff like that. And then in every class, there's always one or two dummies, you know, that just don't make it, you know. And that was me. And the New York State Board of Regents, you know, recognized that early in my educational career, because they placed me in what they called special education. It later came to be known as Welcome Back Cotter. You know. I stayed in the same room for 8 years, you know. The determination of when you were to leave there was whether you were smoking or dating the teacher, you know. And I finally did get out of that school, and I'll never forget that day. It was probably the most traumatic day of my young life. They told me that I was going to go into the high school. And my brother Jack, who's a little older than I am, had taken me over to the high school on that day when you have to get organized and pick out the subjects you're going to take, and New York State Board of Regents had a requirement for all high school students that you take a foreign language. Now, that seems strange to me because I've been getting F in English for 8 years. And my brother said, you know, he said, you don't have much of a chance. And I forget what the choices were. I think it was Italian, French, Spanish, and maybe German or something. It didn't make any difference. They were all way out of my league. But I'm an Irish Roman Catholic, so of course, as a little child, I served on the altar of the church. So I know the confiteor of the Mass, I know the Latin of the Mass and things like that. So my brother, you know, wisely and compassionately, he said, you know, the best shot you got is Spanish. He says it's a little bit like Latin, and he says that might help you out a little bit. So as a freshman, I took Spanish 1. And as a sophomore, I took Spanish 1. And I took Spanish 1 when I was a junior and right on into when I was a senior. And I split from high school, you know, at age 16 and enlisted underage in the United States Marines. And I lost my virginity in a house of ill repute in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I learned more Spanish that night than I did in the whole 4 years in high school, you know. As a matter of fact, talking about schools, you know, I was driving, it's a long drive from where I live down to the airport, you know, in San Francisco, and I had to come to one of our more affluent counties up there, Marin County, land of the hot tubs and the peacock feathers and things like that. And I'm a stonemason by trade, or I was. I haven't for years now. I'm retired, but I was born and raised in the construction industry, and that was my trade, and that's really all I've ever known. And even though I'm out of the trades now, I still have an interest, you know, whenever I go past a construction site or see some different kind of architecture or something, especially stonework, you know. I would sort of drive in and check it out, make sure they're doing it right and things like that. And sort of show you where I come from. This morning I went past a place called Belle Marine Keys and real, you know, top shelf and a big sign out in front of this construction project, you know, this building that's been under construction, saying what it was going to be, you know, and who was building it, and the board of supervisors, and all that kind of stuff. Now, maybe you women won't understand this, but I'm certain you guys will, you know. There's this big sign, and it says, Future Site of the Francis Luella Parker Pennington High School. Jesus Christ. Can you imagine telling somebody you go to Francis Llewellyn Parker Pennington High School? The logo on the football helmet must be a canary. The high school I went to in New York City didn't have a name. You know, had a number. If it had a name, it would have been something like Lucky Luciano Tech. Al Capone Prep, you know. Driver's education in my high school was how to leave the scene of an accident. President of the senior class is a guy by the name of Vito. That ought to tell you the whole thing right there, you know. But enough of that. That sort of shows you where I come from, you know, and I'm not going to get into any big, long story about my woes and sins and all of the trials and tribulations and bad breaks that I had with alcohol. I don't think that's really that important to you of how people get drunk. You know how to do that very well, you know. I sort of like to tell you, you know, something that just recently happened to me, you know. In this little valley that I live in, which is a very famous valley in California, everybody in the country wants to live there, you know, because of its quaintness and its old world charm, and we're very strong on slow growth, and we have no industry there except the wine industry, and I eat in a restaurant. Well, I've been eating in the same restaurant for lunch for about the last 25 years, you know, and it's in between the town of Calistoga and St. Helena, and I've been sitting and eating with the same 12 guys, well, with the exception that we've lost two, but replaced them. 12 of us sit around a round table, you know, like 12 little old ladies, you know, and we get pissed off if somebody sits in our seat, you know, But it's a great hour and a half every day. I really look. It's the best part of my day, you know. I'm the only one of the whole 12 that doesn't drink. The other 11 guys are all the very big names in the wine industry. You'd know them all. Mondavi, Peter Mondavi, Louis Martini, Brother Timothy from Christian Brothers. And just that 12 guys, you know, having an hour and a half to themselves, you know, just telling a couple off-color jokes, talking about the Giants, the 49ers, the Raiders, and you know, women and all sorts of... Well, we don't talk about women when the priest is there, not so much, you know. He gets all excited and starts spilling his soup all over himself. And the place has Italian food, and I love Italian food. That should be very obvious to you. I really love food. I love food so much. I gave up sex for food. I did. I even had a mirror installed in my dining room ceiling, you know. You're bad. You're very bad. And we sit around this table, and because of the prominence of the Napa Valley in the wine industry in the world today, you know, all those wineries are visited on a daily basis by big moguls from all foreign countries all over the world. So occasionally, you know, one of our regular guys will invite his guest, you know, to come down and have dinner or lunch with us, you know, and it's only due to the proximity of the way the tables are set. Whenever they have a guest, they reach right behind where I'm sitting, and they pull a chair from another table, and the visitor always winds up alongside of me, which is fine, you know, unless he's talking Japanese or something like that, you know. But they come from Portugal, France, Italy, Australia, and we get along fine. And after about 5 minutes, they notice that everybody else at the table is drinking wine, because these guys bring their own bottles of wine, their estate wines and their new blends, and they try them out on each other. But my wine glass is always upside down, has been upside down for 25 years. And in that restaurant. And so the inevitable question always comes up from the stranger, you know. Don't you drink? Well, you know, after 30 years, you're allowed to tell a few lies, you know. And so I usually say them silly little things like, well, not today, you know, and I'm going to the dentist this afternoon, or my mother-in-law is coming, and I don't have a mother-in-law, you know. But just to shut them the hell up, you know. And that would be fine. But they don't leave it alone. See? About 10 minutes later, you got your mouth half full of tortellini. And he says, why? Well, I'm not about to stand up and say, well, my name is Gene, and I'm bound by a moral obligation to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I ain't going to go through all of that kind of crap. And, you know, it's always reminded me of another time. We were talking a little bit about it this afternoon. I was privileged to be part of the anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous in Alaska some years ago, and it was in Fairbanks. Because sometimes, you know, we in alcoholics tend to think the whole world knows about alcoholism, you know, and they don't, you know. Because on the Monday morning that I was coming back to the States, mainland or whatever the hell you call it, I was sitting in the airport in Fairbanks, and I was watching this one young guy, about 25 years old. He was over at the bar, you know. Man, he was throwing them in just as fast as they could. Ho, 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 and he left. He reminded me of Bluto, you know, in the Popeye cartoons, you know. And he was dressed like that. He had a big beard on, big thick suspenders, and big boots. And he was just having one hell of a time, you know. And I really sort of envied him, to tell you the truth. And I'll be damned if he didn't wind up alongside of me on the plane. So we get to chatting, and he turns out he was a construction worker from the oil fields up in Prudhoe Bay, and he'd been up there in a 17-month contract, and he'd been up there working 17 months, 7 days a week, 10 hours a day, you know, to get his post together. Now he was on his way home for a furlough to Peoria, Illinois. And he had enough money saved up for a little down payment on the house. He was going to see a little baby that he hadn't seen yet that was born, you know, shortly after he left. So he was really living it up and having a big old time. So, and I could understand that. And every time the girl came by, he ordered a drink. And he said, you want one too? No. And he kept telling me all about the construction fields up there, you know, and we've got the construction in common. And he was telling me about how they work under sub-zero weather and stuff like that. And he kept it up. And he finally ran out of gas about over Seattle someplace, you know. And then he said, by the way, what do you do for a living? Oh, Jesus. And I own, the oldest treatment facility in the state of California, you know, non-medical treatment facility, all AA is all it is. And so I didn't want to tell this guy that. I mean, I'd blow the whole day for him, you know. But I tell him I was a tire manager for Sears and Roebuck or any goddamn thing. But I come out and I says, I own an alcoholic treatment facility. And he looked at me and he said, a what? I said, an alcoholic treatment facility. And he said, what in the hell is that? And, you know, and he meant it. And I said, well, that's a place where people go who don't want to drink anymore. And as innocently as a little newborn baby, you know, he said, well, why would anybody want to do that? And son of a bitch, he was right. Why? Why would anybody want to drink? And that's what these guys asked me. And, you know, for many, many years, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1950. And like I said, you know, I'm a lot better now because I've been through a course of learning and instruction and stuff like that. But I couldn't read very well when I came here, and I didn't understand a lot of things. And I was one of them guys you'd see around AA meetings who always sat in the front row or something like that. And when people would be saying something, I'd go, you know, as I knew what the hell he was talking, he might have been calling me an asshole for all I know. I don't know. And I carried the book around, you know, and I'd... But I didn't know what the hell I was reading at all, you know. And so the program was rather difficult for me at that time. So when I came, I was fortunate, very fortunate, because God put it... I'm going to say something now. I wasn't going to say this, but I know a lot of you people out there, and you'll understand me. I'm not a guy that's really known, you know, to have too much tact. I'm a tell-it-how-it-is guy, you know. I'm a bullshitter in every area of my life except here. You know, this is my life here. And it's nice that we're here on a nice gay occasion having a lot of fun, you know, and stuff like that, but we must never forget. Must never forget where we come from and where we are. And so sometimes, you know, I bring up things that get people's asshole a little red because they don't like what I say. But I can't help that, you know. You know, you and I know, or we should know, by our own experiences, and we can't be so naive to think for 1 minute that everybody in this room is finished drinking or using. Now, you know that's not true, and I know it's not true. As hard as it is to say, there are people sitting in this room right now, and I certainly remember myself amongst them possibilities, who are going to drink or use again whatever the hell their game is. That's how it is. And before you look at me like that, lady, that isn't an original thought of mine, you know. That's in this book. If you get a chance, you can read it, you know, sometime. And that book was written, you know, a little over 55 years ago. And they even knew about this problem that exists today then, because they said, quote, despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will drink again. They will try to prove that they're not alcoholics. That's just how it is. And the scariest thing about returning to drinking, and the reason that we have to come to these meetings, is this. People like you and I, apparently normal people, are capable of making an insane decision when we're sane. And let me explain that to you. In order to have a slip, there was one absolute requirement. You have to be sober. Which means you will make a decision to drink when you are sober. And for people like you and I, to drink is an insane activity. Because the word insanity is defined in any dictionary thusly. Anytime you place your life or the life of others in jeopardy by your actions, that is an insane act. So for you or I to drink again is insanity. So that means that I can make an insane decision when I'm sane. And that's why I come to these things, and that's why I've been coming to them for 43 years. Because I know that any moment that I can make that decision, I know, as hard as it is to believe, that I can be drunk an hour from now walking through that door, even though I'm in the accompaniment of all of the people I love the best. I know that. I don't think the probability exists, but I know the possibility does. And that's why I need this program, as it says, on a daily basis, you know. This is not a solo act. Guy asked me today, you know, he says, well, when do you complete the steps? You'd never complete the steps. If you were in Toronto, Canada in 1965 when Bill Wilson was speaking right out there in the middle of that hockey rink on Saturday night, he told you why. we don't complete these steps.
He didn't say it that way. He said Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed for people who seek a new way of life. Well, the new way of life is those steps, mainly 2 through 12. The reason you eliminate one is because one is the only time alcohol is mentioned, and alcohol to us is death. So it talks about death in the first step. The next 11 steps are all about living. How to live with dignity. How to live with pride. How to live with compassion and love. And that's what those steps teach me. I didn't always know that. I didn't really know. Well, when people would say, why don't you drink? I didn't know. And then when I finally did get to know, I didn't know how to tell you. I didn't know how to say it. And at the times that I would venture enough courage to say it, I'd goof it all up. And you'd laugh at me or giggle at me, or I'd be so embarrassed I'd run away. So I'd done the only thing an alcoholic would do. I'd just shut up. You'd ask me, well, why don't you drink anymore? I wanted to tell you, I wanted to scream it out. Because inside of me, I knew why I didn't. I wanted to holler to the whole world. But I was scared to, because I figured by the time it came out in words, it'd be all mixed up and you wouldn't understand me. And then God stepped in. Give me a break. Well, I don't know if it's a break. I was invited to participate in an AA activity in a... Well, it's a pretty nice place now, but then it was an asshole of a place. Stockton, California. Only place worse than that is Kanab, Utah. And I've been there. And that Maple Grove runs a close second. Jesus, I'll never forget those two experiences. Woo! Willing to go to any length. My God. But I was invited to go to Stockton, California. Jeez. Stockton is not the French Riviera, you know. It's about as exciting as an empty paint can, you know. For a big deal on Saturday in Stockton, you go through the work clothes department of the JCPenney store, you know. Ho, 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 you know. And I was holed up in one of them mama-papa-type motels, trying to keep cool because it gets hot, you know. That's right there in our San Joaquin Valley, and man, it was hot. And I was watching one of them Saturday afternoon classics on TV, you know. Shirley Temple makes it with Godzilla, you know. When all of a sudden the commercial came on. And many of you have seen this commercial. And that commercial had such an impact on my sobriety that I actually researched it. And it was filmed in Richardson Bay, which is a small bay off of San Francisco Bay. And it was filmed on one of our beautiful October days, you know. Any of you are from the Bay Area, you know that this month is our summer. October is summer in San Francisco, you know, not June, July, and August. And it was just a fantastic day, and the bay was just like a sheet of blue glass, you know, like a mirror. And they had all the sailing boats were out there, people sailing around, a little white sail. It looked like a bunch of butterflies out there, you know. And they took the cameras and they zoomed in on one of these sailing vessels and onto the deck. It was a whole bunch of young people, 19, 20, 21-year-old kids, running up and down the decks with cut-off blue jeans on and weird little T-shirts and funny little hats and shimmying up the mast, diving off the yardarm, swinging on the lines, dropping into the bay, just jackassing around, you know, having a big old time. And then the post line came on. And how ironic, because it was advertising beer. It says, you only go around once. Grab all of the gusto you can. And I didn't know what the hell gusto meant. You know, it could have been a goddamn cereal for all I knew. And I'm a dictionary freak. That's this course of learning that I've been embarked on for about 20 years now. And so I went out to the desk, a little mama-papa-type motel, and they lived in the back. And I said, would you have a dictionary? And they did. And I looked up the word gusto. And it says, gusto, slang expression for living. You only go around once. Grab all of the living you can. And that's why at about 10 minutes to 4 this morning, just outside of Calistoga, California,
My dog started licking my hand to let me know it was time to get up. I get up and I said, God help me through today. If I need you, be close by. And with the help of my God, the program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I can get through today without putting a needle in my arm, without chopping the line, without smoking a funny little cigarette, eating any of them pocket rockets, or taking a drink, you know. And I make that decision every day. And I make that decision not because I'm an alcoholic. Oh, no, no, no. I drank plenty as an alcoholic. I make that decision because of the most important thing that anybody who walks the face of this earth will ever experience. And it's a four-letter word called life. L-I-F-E. And you know, there's some things that we take for granted about life, or maybe we don't think about at times, but I think we should. You know, it don't make any difference who you are. Whether you're rich, poor, has nothing to do with the color of your skin, whether you're dumb, ignorant, or smart, whether you're Irish, Roman Catholic, regardless of what the country of your national origin is or the church of your choice. It don't make any difference. One to a customer. That's all you get. One time through. That's the name of the game. And if you take a close look at life, it gets a little scary. The moment that life starts, it begins to get shorter. Every unit of time that goes by is a portion of your life that is over, done, finished. What's the date? The 4th? 5th? What's today? The 8th? Never again will we or anybody else in this room experience 8 p.m. October the 8th, 1963. It's over. It's fun. But don't laugh at me. Try to get 1963 back. But that's it. It's gone. It's done. And you know, some other facts about life. Cold facts. As each unit of time goes by, we're being brought that much closer to the end of our life, which is the other thing that we have in common. All of us will arrive at a point someday when life as we know it ends. And nobody knows when that time is going to be because life is not a VCR. You can't put it on rewind or fast forward or pass back or hold or anything like that. Like a VCR, it goes on at its speed. At its time, not our time. Hurling itself pell-mell towards that inevitable end. So when I look at life like that, I make a very selfish decision. Selfish as we had defined it in AA. And I don't think my decision is any different than yours. I want every bit of life I can get. I want to go every place there is to go. I want to see everything there is to see. I want to hear every song that was ever sung, read every book that was ever written. I want it all. And there's nothing wrong even with wanting it all, as long as I have enough sense to know, well, you're not going to get it all. But that should make you and I a little bit better off than them so-called normies out there. Because you and I know or should know something that they don't know. We know that we can get more out of life, clean and sober, than we ever got out of it using and abusing. And we didn't have to be told that. We didn't have to hear that from a podium. We didn't have to read about that in a book or a pamphlet or see it on a tape. Out and found out for ourselves. Actual, factual proof. So that is what brings us to that decision they talk about in the book. It is generally a dilemma. Will precede our decision whether to continue on in our madness. And I know of no better word to describe the life of the practicing addict or alcoholic than madness, or to reach out for recovery. I was fascinated by the word dilemma, and I run to my dictionary. Because dilemma is used twice in our literature. In the big book, it's used where it says, lack of power was our dilemma. And then when AA comes of age, it says generally a dilemma precedes our decision.
And I grasped my dictionary and I looked up in quite a few of them dictionaries and trying to find out what the hell dilemma really meant. Because it's an exciting word. You know, oh, something's going to happen, you know. And I couldn't get any satisfaction out of the dictionaries. And at that time, we had one of them overeducated school teachers in our group, Paul. And I collared him out there in the parking lot one night after a meeting, and he knows my problem. And I said, Paul, tell me what in the hell dilemma means. But, you know, tell me so I'll understand. So he thought for a minute, and he was sort of in a hurry, you know. He said, well, Duff, he says, the dilemma is when you have the opposite answers for the same question, but both answers are valid. I mean, this guy's going through early male menopause or something. How the hell could you have the opposite answers for the same question? And when I questioned with that, he said, you just keep thinking. Well, I don't know how long I think. I don't know whether it was a day or a week or a month or a year. But all of a sudden, one day, I realized exactly what he was talking about, that dilemma. And it also focused me on the strong belief in a power greater than myself. And it convinced me that this program has always been divinely guided for each of us. Because, you see, my dilemma happened on West Madison Street, and that's a Skid Row area in Chicago, Illinois. And I'd been living down there for 17 months and the only way to describe it is as an animal. And I had relegated my drinking now to that so-called quiet drinking. No longer even had to communicate, you know, vocally with anybody. My headquarters was a scumbag of a place called Big Rock Child. Filthy, rotten snake pit, you know. And in the wintertime, I hustled around in a big old U.S. Army surplus overcoat, you know. Only thing good about that was them big pockets, you know, because you could put wine in them pockets and nobody could see the top of the bottle, you know. And that was important. And let me tell you how it is, and there are people in this room that knows what I'm talking about. As a matter of fact, there's a point of interest that I might interest you. I got a little mauled in this afternoon. My room faces out on the street, and I see a building over there that says Hotel Marion. There's a Marion Hotel in every town in the United States, you know. And if the rooms in the Hotel Marions could only talk, they'd tell some horrible, horrible tales, you know. And I've been living down there, and it usually went like this. At 6 a.m., you know, you sort of shuffle into them places. They call it the wine shuffle, you know, and you have to go through probably what is the most hideous moment in the life of a Skid Row alcoholic, you know. Because at this level, you know, you're living in the belief that your life is going to be over in every 20-minute period that goes by. In other words, if I don't get a drink 20 minutes from now, I'm dead. I had reached that point, and some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, that if I don't get a drink, I'm going to die. In the nature of my work, I hear that on a daily basis. On a daily basis, I hear either a man or a woman, and excuse my language, I'm just going to quote it. Jesus Christ, give me a fucking drink before I die! And you know and I know that they mean it. And they believe it. There came a time in the lives of many of us in this room when we were convinced that we were going to die if we didn't get a drink or a hit or whatever the hell the thing was. And that's how it is when you're living down there as an animal. As soon as I would get a drink, my only thought would be, am I going to get another one 20 minutes from now, or am I going to die? And you can call out a bottom if you want. And you have to go... Let me tell you something else about alcoholics on Skid Row. You can always separate them from the common drunk on Skid Row very easily. The alcoholics cry. They always cry before their first drink. You can walk in and there's just 10 guys sitting at that bar getting ready to take a drink. You can pick out the alcoholics, the 4 guys that are crying. Because, you see, they're still burdened with guilt. And guilt is the best thing in the world that can happen to an alcoholic. Best thing in the world. Because guilt is the signal. Guilt is the signal that down deep in that gut, there still must be some decency. Because if there was no decency in that gut, there'd be no guilt. And decency is the thing that has to ignite the willingness to stand up one day and say, I don't want to be like this. And then you make the entry. But first you got to go through that moment, you know. That bartender stands opposite you and he's got that bottle of cheap wine in his hand, that 7-ounce paper cup in his hand, and he ain't pouring nothing till he sees something. And then you go into the pockets, right? Bottle caps, bus tokens, Japanese money, electrical conduits, pennies, just a whole. And you stand there in total terror, hoping to Christ that pretty soon something in that pile adds up to 15 cents. Because 15 cents stands between you and dying. 15 cents for 4 ounces of lousy wine. Oh, no, not that Napa Valley wine, you know. Something like the Pride of Orem, something like that. And then tears come down, see, because you got that guilt. And then, oh, Jesus, you're saved. You got enough. You got enough. You're going to live 20 more minutes. And he pours it, you know. And then that's when that dilemma comes. You know what I'm talking about. You all know what I'm talking about. You didn't have to be in Rothschild's. It was probably in your kitchen or home or any other place. But you stand there and you look at that goddamn drink and you know it's killing you. You know that. You've always known that. Jesus Christ, if I drink that, it's going to kill me. And then that other guy starts talking to you in the back. But if you don't drink it, you're going to die. Opposite answers for the same question. And they're both valid. If I drink it, it kills me, and if I don't drink it, I die. How can you and I make a decision at a moment like that? We are incapable of making that decision. So the decision is made by who? Who? Who makes the decision? I hope none of you really think you're the reason you're here. I don't think any of you think you made the decision. I can remember the very day that I was asked to come to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was building a high school. The company I was working for was building a high school in a place called Rochelle, Illinois. And I was the boss on it only because it was a 99% masonry project. And I had a bricklayer working for me by the name of Eddie Friel, who was a pain in the ass. Every week his wages were getting garnished. They were repossessing his pickup truck. He'd never show up on Monday. If I gave him his paycheck before noon on Wednesday, he wouldn't come back from lunch. But he was a nice guy. And I hated his guts. And then all of a sudden, the bill collector stopped coming around. Nobody came to pick up his truck anymore. He was there every Monday. Didn't make any difference when I gave him his check. And then one day he walked into the little field office we had, a little construction shanty on the job site. And he said to me, the superintendent, the big war hero. He says, Duff, well, he called me Boomer then. He said, Boomer, he says, I belong to AA. Would you like to go to a meeting? Holy Christ. My butt just puckered. Man, I was furious. I looked with them brick tongues and a pickaxe handle, something to change his face. I was never so humiliated in my life. Alcoholic. Go with you. Oh, my God, almighty. And before I fired him, I wanted to tell him what I thought of him and his suggestion. And I mustered up every filthy, rotten, stinking word that I knew. And I mixed them all together with all of the hate and the physical violence that I knew, and I brought them up to my mouth and spit them right out. something is straight. And when it came out, it said, where is it? Now, why would I say that? It certainly shouldn't have been me to say that. And it couldn't have been Eddie, because he asked the question, and we were the only two guys in there that I could see. So, undoubtedly, we divinely guided. But then, you know, I'm no shining example of this program. Well, I came in here, you know, 24 years old, and I drank for the first 6 years on this program. It took me 6 years to get one full year of sobriety. Then I put together eight, and then I went to a Marine reunion, had a couple of drinks on a weekend, and that busted that. Now I'm sober 30 years. I still go to Marine reunions, but they all know I'm on AA now. You know. But what turned it around? And I'd like to tell you what turned it around in closing, you know. I had committed myself to a sponsor. And I'm ashamed to tell this at times. As a matter of fact, I don't tell this to many people. I was convinced that I didn't belong here. I was convinced that you were wrong. I was convinced that Eddie was wrong, that the book was wrong, and it had nothing to do with a guy like me, you know. And I wanted to prove that to you. So I was doing a little time in an institution in Illinois, you know. And jerks from the nation I used to come out there every Sunday night, you know. I'd go, you know, oh, not to learn anything. You know, they always brought cookies with them and a couple of loose cigarettes and a quarter or two. Your values sort of change, you know, when you're doing things. And I hated that asshole who was the secretary, you know. I used to call him the Gray Eagle, you know. He had silver hair. He wore a blue suit, a white shirt, and a maroon tie. And he looked like he'd just come back from 8 weeks on Miami Beach. And he was the vice president of the locomotive division for General Motors. His name was Bob Lambrick. I hated that guy with a passion. Of course, I know now why I did. He represented everything that I wanted to be, and I knew I wasn't. And it was Bob was the guy that I finally, through an identification process, asked to be my sponsor, you know. And I'm all set, you know. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? Something I thought I'd never do. And he said, no. Huh. You talk about humiliation, huh? But before I could fire a salvo at him, you know, he said, I just want to tell you what it's going to be like if I'm your sponsor. And that way, next Sunday night, you can do what you want. So I stood there with that egotistical, cocky attitude we have, you know. Come on, throw it. I can handle anything you bunch of wimps got, you know. And he says, Duff, if I'm your sponsor, I'm going to make every decision in your life for the next year without any further comment or question from you. Well, if Sister B was here right now, she says, that's when I use the F word. But I went back and I thought it over for a week, you know, and I knew he was right. And finally I asked that man to be my sponsor. But here's why I asked him. He was one of the founding members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chicago. He was one of them gurus in the Chicagoland area. You know, he was always Bob was this, Bob was that, everybody, Big Book Bobby. Spoke all over the country, you know. He was the big deal, you know. And in my sick mind, you know, I wanted everybody to know that I had the best possible sponsor you could have. Bob! And that I had made this commitment that I would make no decision in my life for a year without Bob okaying it. I want everybody to know that. My plan was to do that for 364 days. And then on the 365th day, I was going to come up before you with a group like this and say, well, I'm Bob Pigeon. I have done everything this man has told me to do for a whole year. And then reach underneath the podium and pull out a bottle of VO and drink it right in front of you and say, see, it doesn't work. That was my plan. But what I had you figured on was that during that year, as a result of taking those inventories, my life changed, and it began to get better. It began to get better. And the night that it really happened, under this commitment that I had to Bobby, I had a schedule of meetings where I was supposed to go and all of that kind of crap. And I had to go to a meeting in a place called Crystal Lake, Illinois, sort of an affluent, big-time money place outside of Chicago.
And I hated to go. I hated to go to all the meetings. This one I sort of liked a little bit more, only for one selfish reason. There was a lady there by the name of Helene. Helene belongs in the Roaring Twenties, in the gay, Great Gatsby days, you know. She wore a big hat that flopped around way out here. She wore gloves in the summertime. I never saw anybody do that in my life. Way the hell up to here, you know. And she was always the first one there. And I'd come up with the guys in the pickup truck, and I'd hop out of the pickup truck, and Helene would always go, "Oh, Gene, it's such a delight to see you." Now, I didn't want anybody to know I liked that, you know. But I did, you know. Nobody ever talked to me like that, you know. It's such a delight, you know. And because we were always the first guys there, we'd have to, it was a discussion meeting, we'd set the tables up for Helene. And then she used to go around where each chair was going to be with them papers, you know, have all the holes in them, what the hell do you call them things? You know, they have little holes in them, you put them in front of the, burlies. And then they put one of them little Dixie cup things on it and fill it up with little nuts and bullshit, jelly beans and stuff like that. She had them all where you sit. Everybody, if you got to sit at that table, you got one of them little cups, you know. Well, I never got one because I always waited until everybody was seated. Then I come in and I go sit in the corner someplace with the rest of the dummies, you know. Now, I'm going to tell you the truth. This is exactly how it happened, so I don't want you to think I'm being sexist or anything like that, a feminist or anything like that. This one night, you know, they're sitting there and I'm in the back, you know, wishing the goddamn meeting it in, you know. Halfway through the meeting, boy comes stumbling down the stairs of Selma, drunker than five sailors on Pearl Harbor Day. Man, did she have a package on. Boom, 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 boom. And you've seen her, you know. Every group has a Selma and every group has a Helene. You know what Helene is? Helene is the group that you have, the lady you have in your group where you go to meetings. She's the one when the secretary says, "Helene, is there anything you'd like to say tonight?" She says, "No, thanks. I think I'll just pass. I'm so grateful to be here." That's all the hell I ever heard you say. And here comes Selma. And Selma's interrupting all the speakers and the secretary. "Selma, sit down. We'll talk to you after the meeting." And Selma would sit down and somebody start talking and up would jump Selma. "Selma, sit down. For Christ's sake, we'll talk to you later." "Selma, sit down. Look like you're doing the Vatican aerobics, you know." And finally, all of a sudden, one of her tirades, up jumped little Helene. And at the top of her lungs, she says, "Selma, sit down and shut the F word up." Holy Christ, my head went up like that. It was like having a whole bunch of, the whole AA in front of you. The whole world. And somebody saying, "Pick out the one person in the world that would never say the F word." And everybody would pick out Helene, you know. And boy, you know what happened then. Selma turned on her. The only way that we can, and we're vicious and we're vulgar and we're rotten. Boy, and she said, "Satan says, Colleen, that I wouldn't even repeat here tonight. We were all embarrassed and we had our heads down. My God, shut up, you know." And boy, she just kept it up and Elaine just stood there looking at her. And then the last thing Selma said when she was running out of gas, she says, "Helene, what makes you so goddamn great? You came in here 9 years ago and I came in here and you never took another drink. See, what'd you do that I didn't do?" And boy, my head went up with that, you know. What the hell did she do? All she ever said was "pass." I'm gonna let him in. Put out them goddamn candies and things, you know. And then she looked out there at us like I'm looking out there at you, as though she's saying, "Well, hell, there's only one answer to that. You know what it is." And she said, "Why, Helene, or I, Selma," she said, "I just did what I was told. It's this simple." It didn't strike me right then and then, but about an hour later, I'm sitting in the back of this pickup truck going home, and I'm thinking, and all of that cornball crap that I had heard in AA, all of them lip service things, them little mottos and them slogans, if that was a moment of clarity, then that's what it was, because all of a sudden I understood what they meant.
I understood what it meant when it said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. They were right. They were right when they said, he does it first things first. If you want what we have, abandon yourself to God. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. All of these things made sense. And I began to see what I call the guarantee. And I don't want to cause any controversy here, and don't argue until I get the hell out of here Sunday. For years and years, we say there's no guarantee in that program. I don't want to be the guy to say I'm going to change that book or anything like that because I lived that book. But the way I understand, there is a guarantee, and it's in black and white right here in this book, and it was read here tonight if you were listening. First, we have to remind ourselves when this book was written and who wrote it. And the situation surround the writing of it. There's a guy right there that would know right there. But there was a lot of discussion, a lot of argument. It was 79 people wrote the book, Alcoholics. Not 100, 79. And they were no different than we are here as a group. Atheists, agnostics, believers, non-believers, slippers, sliders. The most sobriety any of them could have had was 2 years, because the book was written 2 years after the program started. And they argued amongst themselves just as we would argue if we would be writing the book tonight. Some guys wanted their pictures in the book, some didn't want it. Everybody wanted it. Group of drunks! Group of drunks! And then in this myth, if it's a myth or a legend, whatever it is, but it was told to me by somebody I respect very much in this program. Out of the group, somebody said, well, let's not put nothing in the goddamn book unless we all agree on it. Not really thinking what a stupid thing that was to say. Can you imagine trying to get 79 alcoholics? Can you imagine trying to get 4 alcoholics? But obviously they did. They did. The book is written. The atheists agreed. The agnostics agreed. Non-believers agreed. Slippers, sliders, all agreed. And in the 5th chapter of this book is the guarantee. The 2nd and 3rd of the 3 pertinent facts. They were read here tonight. 2nd pertinent fact. We believe, that's an odd word right off the bat for atheists and agnostics to agree on. We believe that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And you can't deny the next fact. But God, and they called him God, they didn't call it a chair, a rock, or a tree. They said, but God could. Now, there's no more definite statement than that. God can. And then, to smash down our denial, he said, and will. And then again, the divine guidance. They told us we could recover. They told us where to go to recover. And then they gave you the choice. They said, if he were sought. God could and would if he were sought. I went out and I sought this God. I sought this God through what it told me to do in the 10th step and other steps, through prayer and through meditation. And one day, God acted on me. He went out there amongst people like you. And he picked out a man and he said, you take this message to that asshole out there. And then one day, that guy met me. And on a night like this, I guess, he handed me the most precious thing in my life. He handed me my life. He gave me life. He gave me back my life, just like you have been given back your life. And he told me that, don't just think for one moment that it's free. He said, there are conditions surrounding the presence of this gift. He says, Duff, I want you to take this gift, this thing called sobriety. He says, don't look for it because you can't see it. He said, it's not wrapped up, but don't have ribbons on it or anything like that. He says, but it's there, just like it's in this room right now. None of you are carrying this gift right now. And they said, all I had to do was reach out for it. If I wanted it. And I reached out for it. And I took it. And as I took it, Bob said to me, Duff, you take this gift and you pull it close to your heart. And you protect it with your life, because this gift is your life. And as you hold it, you take from it its courage, its strength, its compassion, its love, and its understanding. And he said, Duff, if you just do those few things sooner than you expect, and perhaps a lot sooner than you deserve, you'll be able to stand up and walk once more amongst your fellows. And Duff, on the day that you can do that, on the day that you can rise up just one more time with some semblance of dignity back in your life, we ask you only to bring the gift back. Thank you very much.